I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Alan Cumming, and welcome to My Shelves. My shelves are sort of a museum of my life. I like to keep things from my travels that are, to me anyway, the very essence of the experiences I've had. Sort of portals, if you will, to a specific time and place. And the inspiration for stories and memories and musings. Here is one of my favourite cushions. I love a cushion. And here's a cushion with my friend Esther the Wonder Pig's face on it. If you don't know who Esther the Wonder Pig is, please find out immediately. Here's my Alice in Wonderland watercolour set. It's a big set of watercolours, and the outside is in a sort of one of those old-fashioned tins with illustrations of Alice in Wonderland and the Mad Hatter and everyone at the tea party. And it's so nice, I've never used it, I just put it on a shelf. And today I'm talking to Andrew St. Clair.
But neither of us had cars or a great deal of kind of skills in the actual making of lampshades.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Andrew St. Clair is one of my dearest, oldest, bestest friends, and he's also a man of many parts. He's been an actor, translator, a Steadicam operator, a documentary maker. Oh, he also was a lampshade mogul. He had a company that made these beautiful lampshades called Chandeliers for the People. He's also an olive and an almond farmer and just a total darling, as you will hear. Andrew, lovely, lovely Andrew St. Clair. The thing I've got here, it's like two things. It's like two photos, but there's not. It's like a piece of card or two pieces of card with like a photocopied photo stuck to it. It's sort of weird. I don't know why that should be the case. Do you?
What is it? What are the photos of?
Photos are of us. One's of me. One's of you. We're in your flat in London. And we've both got pajamas on, and we've got like, but there's obviously I've taken the photo of you, and you've taken the photo of me, and we're both leaning back because we've got cucumbers on our eyes.
Oh yes,
and
yes.
We've got face masks on as well. So I remember it was the night of your lampshade show, and we must have gone back to yours and relaxed, and had a few drinks or whatever, and had a sort of a spa night.
Yeah, I think we did. We stayed up. You came, you were lampshade boy, weren't you, at our show? You came and helped doing the actual selling.
Yes, I loved that so much.
Oh, it was such a laugh. We did them, yeah, was it in the Cobden Club in Notting Hill or somewhere?
Yes, it's in a club. And it was just, I remember the room was just full of all these beautiful lampshades on little tables and everything. And it was like, loads of people came, and I had a little. I just loved it. There's something about. It's like how I like being, you know, being a bartender at Club Cumming. I love it. I just love sort of being in touch with everybody and zipping around. And I had a little cloth over my arm, which was used to take unscrewing the light bulbs because it was hot.
Yeah, pre-lead bulbs, and also because there was you and me and Lauren, my lampshade friend, my lampshade partner, and I think we all got. Did you come a wee bit early or something? I'm not quite sure. But anyway, somehow or other, you ended up being lampshade assistant. So our equipment was a little towel over our arms to be able to take the bulbs off and a torch to shine through. So if the lampshade, which wasn't on a lamp, we had a little torch that we could shine to see, because I think that particular collection, as we put our lampshades into, was called the Dracula range. So we had these coloured linings, do you remember? So if you shone the torch through from inside, it would change with the light.
Two things. Yes, I loved that.
Yeah.
So tell me, what was the provenance of Chandeliers for the People?
Well, it was that I had a friend who was a, I was doing some, I don't know, some acting job, I think, back in the day. And my friend Catherine was a makeup person. And through her, I met this person called Lauren, who became my friend. And we were both kind of at a bit of a kind of loose end. She was trying to write her first children's book. And I guess I was looking for some sort of acting job. And when we met, we started talking about lampshades and how hard it was to find them. And for some reason, after we kind of met that first time, we both went off to look for lampshades and sure enough, found it incredibly hard to find a nice one or a cheap one. And we just thought, why don't we make them ourselves? Which was a kind of crazy thing to do.
But, you know, it's absolutely true that I always think that when you find a lovely lamp, like especially like if, you know, at a flea market or a jumble sale or a whatever, you know, some old, I was up in the country when I go to, you know, you have the signs on trees saying, you know, estate sale today, and you go there, yes. Some gorgeous lamp, you think, oh, that'd be so nice. It's so difficult to get a lampshade. Why is that, Andrew?
I don't
know. As lampshade guru.
Well, we were both sent, there was a shop in I think Kensington Church Street, probably still there actually, but it was a shop that I think it's called something like Anne's Shades or Shades by Anne. We'd both been told that was the place to go and look for shades. So in the kind of few weeks, I guess, before we saw each other again, we'd been to Anne's Shades and failed to find a nice shade. And I suppose it just, I don't know what it was, we just thought it'd be really good to find a shade that wasn't either kind of, there were some that were kind of crazy, you know, people had stuck kind of feathers all over them or sort of, they made them look like a big pair of pants or something, but somewhere in between. So not quite sort of just the pure kind of ones they like to call fun, a fun shade. We were trying to find something that was kind of going to be kind of, I suppose, what our friends would like. And then I guess because we're being to Anne's
Shade. So fun but classy.
Exactly. And then we got into the kind of whole sort of, I guess as we were thinking about it, we spent lots of time just meeting and chatting about our potential lampshade future. And we rather like the idea of it being a kind of political thing. You deserve to have a good lampshade. So that's where the name Chandeliers for People came from, as a kind of reaction to Shades by Anne or Shades by Jeremy or Acorn Interiors. So it would be quite funny to have this idea that everybody deserved a chandelier, which in fact was a lampshade. So that's where it came from.
Yeah. And they were so beautiful.
They were really lovely. Was it you,
because I remember like it got quite... I remember knowing you over that time, it got quite overwhelming. You were kind of like a lampshade mogul.
Yes. Well, the problem was, of course, the bit that we really liked was the lounging around on sofas discussing the kind of, you know, philosophy of light and the different this and that and the chandeliers for people. All that bit was what we enjoyed. But neither of us had cars or a great deal of kind of skills in the actual making of lampshades. So we spent hours on end trekking off to Southall. We'd buy lots of fabrics, sari fabrics in Southall in West London. And then we'd find man living in this place somewhere up by Stamford Hill. And he made the metal frames. So we'd have to go up there again on sort of tubes and buses to with our sari fabrics to show him what we wanted to make. Then we had to take the combination of all that to someplace in Suffolk to be made. But all of us going on trains.
I remember you going to Suffolk, yes.
It was crazy.
Big bags of lampshades, yeah.
And then I think there was another stage of the journey, of the process too, where they had to go to Millwall, somewhere in southeast London, to be sprayed. So it's just crazy. We spent our whole life just sort of trekking, rather than one kind of van driving shades from one place to another. It was us with sort of hand luggage, big bags of lampshades going from place to place.
Did you sell them just like you had shows and sold them to your friends, or did you sell them in shops?
We tried to sell them in shops and we didn't know anything. I mean, not only trying to set up a business that involves so many stages without a car or a van was kind of crazy, but we didn't really know how to sell them. And so we'd go around to different shops when they were made and we'd just turn up like kind of traveling salesmen. And they'd all be really polite and go, oh yeah, lovely, lovely. Oh, I love them. At the moment, we're quite full of things like that. But next time, you know, when we stock up in the next season, we'll get back in touch. And they never did.
Yeah.
So we thought, well, what we should do, we discovered, in fact, that was a kind of key thing not to do that. But what you should really do is have your shades in a studio, which is my flat, and invite all those shops people over to look at them. And then they'd be so excited and in competition, they'd buy them.
Well, that's what I remember from that night. Well, and many nights, but that night in particular, it was just that room was just inundated with the stunning lampshades. I mean, it was like a lampshade
showroom. Exactly.
We got a little, you know, woozy, a little intoxicated. And I remember it was a little, the lighting was so good. It was like a good, very good lighting for having had a few.
Yes. I imagine you must have taken it because it was a one-off. Well, what we did, rather than selling them to shops in the end, we'd have these one-off kind of shows. And that was one of them, I guess. So I imagine we'd taken all our shades back afterwards. And as we were stacking them up, got a bit woozy, had some sort of cocktails or something. And there was a handbag
imbibed.
I think there was a handbag.
Oh, that's
involved.
Right, a handbag lampshade. Yeah, that's what we're holding in the pictures.
Yes.
You have a sort of a bent or a propensity for having lots of different jobs. I've known you for several decades now, and the number of different things you've done. Let's think, you've been a translator, a Steadicam operator, yes, a farmer. I mean, it's didn't you do noises for porn films once?
I did noises for porn films. Yeah, I've done, I've kind of jack of all trades, I guess. They're like, what's that program used to be on? Duncan's Dares, remember that? When the blue key yes, person would go off yes. and do these crazy jobs. But he would do things like kind yes. of, you know, being a soldier or walking across a tightrope. But I'd be like a Steadicam operator or a dog groomer was my selection.
How did you... Oh, you were a dog groomer too?
Well, they were very temporary. Most of my little tasks wouldn't last very long. So my Steadicam operator was... Not operator. I was a guide, the Steadicam man, just because I'd met somebody who needed that person. So we're often kind of one-off.
So you like walk behind him, making sure he doesn't fall over or
exactly.
something.
And this was all filmed on a roof, a flat roof. It was quite, my job was quite important. and I had to I wasn't allowed to tap him because that would move the camera. And I wasn't really allowed to say anything either because that also might be recorded.
It would be heard, yeah.
So it was a bit of a nightmare job. And he nearly did plummet over a roof a few times, but not in the end.
I was just going to say, I mean, like, don't mean to cause offence, but if it was anything like your translation, I remember you were about to go to translate in Cuba with a friend of ours and for him. And we were out for dinner just before you all went, and we were in this restaurant in Spain, and you couldn't remember the word for lamb. And you said, I would like the dish that is made from little sheep or something.
Yeah, I'd like that one. The meat that comes from the animal that makes wool. I think that's what it was. I talked my way around
that's
that.
That's even worse.
I'd forgotten I'd got myself on that trip as a translator. God, I had, didn't I? With incredibly basic Spanish. And yes, God, yes. I think that was a, kind of the story of lots of those jobs, actually. I managed to scam my way in and just about get through it. There are a few kind of moments in Cuba, I remember, where I didn't really have a clue what I was supposed to be translating, so I just made it up. And hoped it got. You know, I remember hearing, do you remember in the 70s, 80s or something? Maybe 80s, 90s. There was a sudden rush of sort of martial art films that were kind of in sort of, I suppose, second grade cinemas. They'd be kind of on the screen 2, 3, 4. And somebody told me that they'd just bought them in bulk from China. And they were all dubbed. But nobody had bothered to know what they're actually saying. They just made the sort of the noises and the words they thought might fit in. So when a Chinese person would watch the English version, it would bear any relation to the original. And that was a bit like my Cuban translation. I just thought those hand gestures, those eyebrow movements, that must mean, no, I cannot play this part like this. So I just said, no, she's not very happy with that line, which probably saying, I want to go to the toilet or something, but it seemed to work.
I thought you were referring to your porn noises career there when you're talking about the voiceover stuff. How did that happen?
That happened again. That happened by somebody. I met somebody at a party who said I was in Barcelona and I was being there for a while. And he said, oh, you should get into this thing that I've been doing, which is doing voiceovers for this particular kind of film studio. So, oh, okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, I'll look them up. And so I looked them up, and this particular film studio was a vast porn distributor. And for some reason, lots of porn films go to this film studio in the kind of outskirts of Barcelona and get dubbed into different languages. And so they need all the different languages versions with the noises included. So I rang them up and they said, oh, yeah, great. Okay. English. Perfect. Okay. We'd like to send along a tape to kind of see what you can do. So without any kind of warning of any, they didn't send me a kind of an example of what I should be doing, just a tape for me to imagine. So I had to imagine what this scene might do, but might involve noise-wise, bit of groaning, grunting, sort of ooh.
And what you did in addition, you like sent them in a tape of you like doing sex.
Yeah, yeah. And that sadly was as far as that job got. Actually, I never got taken on.
So what was your tape like? What did it consist of?
Well, I can't remember. It's a lot of sort of ooh ah. Hmm. Sort of, and some heavy breathing, and I just couldn't. I hadn't even seen the film. I didn't know what special area we were in. Whether it was sort of like bestial, so it'd be a sort of panting Labrador, or I had no idea. So I just made a kind of coverall kind of sex noise. And I have a good friend who's a Foley artist. So I remember ringing her. Foley artist being that person that adds all the sounds to films and stuff. So I'm ringing her and
like
asking
the scraping of your microphone right now. It feels that's a bit of a Foley. It's just funny, sort of like
adding an extra scrape.
It's exactly. Yeah, they have like little boxes of old tape, you know, like the tape out of cassettes, and they sort of make that, they lift that up and down, and it sounds like someone's walking on pebbles or something.
Exactly, and little sort of boxes of gravel tricks. And different shoes and paper and stuff. So I rang her to see if she knew anything about it, but she had never covered sex noises either. So it's quite a closed area, it seems. It's quite a kind of difficult to get any advice on how you make Foley noise, a Foley'd sex noise. I don't know.
I have to say the worst thing, you know, that when you do looping, when you're an actor, you do, you know, you have to do the lines again, or you have to, sometimes there's changes in the lines and you have to sort of make them, you know, there'll be you speaking, then they'll cut away to someone. And when they cut away, you have to say new words and make the sentence work when it comes back to you. It's really difficult. But the worst thing of all is when you have to revoice your sex scenes. I once had to revoice an orgasm that I did. And it's embarrassing enough, you know, pretending to have an orgasm, but having to redo it in like a darkened room with a bunch of kind of guys all looking at you through the glass.
Or the headphones on, listening to every detail.
Headphones on, yeah. Now, can we go again? Can we take that again, Alan? A little loud on the end there.
Not very convincing,
just the worst thing ever. Not very convincing.
That was another of my mini jobs, actually. I did once, there was a Peter Greenaway film that had been shot in Slovakia, somewhere in Eastern Europe. And everybody except the main characters were Eastern Europeans who were cast very, very quickly. And when they got the kind of recording back, lots of them spoke with these crazy accents, even they're supposed to be kind of medieval British people or Europe. Anyway, so that little mini job was adding to those lips the English version of whatever they were supposed to be saying. And that was more difficult than the porn, actually. I'd rather have done the porn, I think.
I'd rather have done the porn. And also now, I'm just thinking it's hilarious that you're like an almond and olive farmer, because I mean you actually are that's true.
She produced them.
You like spend a lot of your time rearing almonds, or not rearing almonds, but sort of, what do you call it, nurturing almonds.
Yes, we do. It always seems a bit kind of Marie Antoinette playing shepherdess in a sort of way. We're not there all the time. And they obviously do need a lot. Well, not so much, but they do. You know, if you're going to do it really properly, there's a lot of pruning and kind of. We don't do any ploughing. We're going for the more kind of sustainable version. But there's a lot of stuff to do.
You're always with your what do you call it? Your shifter? What's that thing called? Your Fitzer?
Oh yes, the electric strimmer.
What do you call it?
Strimming.
You're always strimming.
Yeah. There's a lot of activity going on, but we don't produce an enormous amount. Yeah, it's pretty good. And that was the thing. We didn't really kind of notice. We obviously noticed, but it wasn't sort of, oh, yeah, it's got almonds and olives. Lovely, very nice. I had a garden. And, of course, once we got there and were sort of visiting there and being there a lot, we then thought, oh, my God, we've got to look after all these trees. So that's how it happened.
What would happen if you didn't? Like, what would happen to the almonds and the olives? Would they stop producing or something?
I think they would in the end. Yeah, almonds kind of are quite delicate. They would get they'd end up first. Olives seem to be completely immortal. They go on and on forever. You have to prune them to make sure they keep producing things. And as I said, we're not there that much. We're there enough to keep it all going, but we probably should be there more to kind of really be producing proper quantities.
Hello. Hello and welcome to Out to Lunch with me, Jay Rayner, the podcast in which I take a particularly brilliant famous person to a top restaurant and grill them to a turn. In this latest season, you'll find me having delicious dinners with the likes of Patrick Keelty, David Hare, Nina Conti, Dame Eileen Atkins and Mary Beard, and the reliably outrageous Miriam Margolyes.
Richard E. Grant was on that.
He has an almost compulsion to smell whatever's around him. Has he never come and sniffed you?
Probably wisely, no.
All that and so much more. So do join me. Out to Lunch with Jay Rayner. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I love one time when we came to visit you, and it was because what I didn't realize is that when you harvest your olives, a big truck comes and they put a big net thing round the bottom of the olive tree, and then the machine shakes the olive tree like really vigorously. That's how they do it. So it's like shaking it, so all the olives fall into this and they catch it in this net. But of course, there's some that fall off the sides or they miss some. And so what we did was we raked up all the sort of reject ones or the ones that missed and took them down in big buckets down to the village where the sort of olive oil repository was. And it was so exciting. I loved it so much because you could see, you pour your olives in and they weigh it first, don't they, to see how much you've got. And then they can actually make olive oil for you right there and then. Mm. Or you could just take the money and run. We took the money and run. But I just think it's so exciting.
That machine that comes to shake the trees is called a vibrator, which caused some confusion at the beginning. A vibrador comes and vibrates the trees. So it's like when they were first saying, would you like us to bring over our vibrator? We thought, oh, it must be, again, my translation was, not sure if I'm still a few stages back in my vocabulary skills. But it turned out to be the right word.
Andrew, tell us about the time you had the guy working on was he Croatian?
And
you were using the translator.
Oh my God, you're the running theme of translation mistakes or potential mistakes.
Yeah.
Oh,
that was was he there? Why did you have a Polish man working for you? What was going
on? It was a weird thing about another foreigner living in the area had decided that he couldn't find anybody who was capable of repairing his house, which is in the village. And I think his brother lived in Germany and had used this Polish man to kind of do up his house in Germany somewhere, and was very cheap and efficient and cool and did things very quickly and, you know, was a really good worker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he didn't have enough work just on this friend's house. So he said to us, why don't we share the flight to get him over and employing him? So I'll use him for 2 weeks and you use him for 2 weeks. Maybe could pass him on to somebody else. He could be there for 6 weeks doing up various friends' houses. And somehow or other, it fell to us to be the first people in this rota. So I picked him up from the airport. I had a little app. I'd managed to fit a kind of Polish to English app into my phone. So theoretically, I talked in English and out it came as Polish. So once we established we had no language in common at all, I got onto the app. So on the drive down, I'd sort of say things like, oh, that's the place where this happens, or these mountains are called this or that. And I'd turn it off and then play the app back to him. And it said, and he seemed, nodding quite happily. And then we got to the house.
Oh, so it was like he heard a voice. It wasn't just written down. He heard an actual voice.
And it wrote it down for you to access it later. But he heard the voice. He was all very smiley and happy with it. And then I think the next day we were showing him things to do, what we would, you know, what the work would like him to do. And one of them was to fit a gutter to collect some rainwater on the side of the house.
So I'm already worried about the word gutter.
Exactly. It gets worse. So it was what I was meaning to say to him was, if you got the ladder ahead of me, then you'll be able to see where I'd like to fit the gutter. And then we'd put it on these. And there was also technical talk about him being on the ladder ahead of me, basically. And I remember him looking a little bit startled when I played back this recording to him. But it's all in Polish, so I didn't know. And then as the kind of week progressed, he got more and more kind of difficult and kept refusing to do things we asked him to do and do exactly the opposite of what we asked him to do. And eventually he just left. We just had to pass him on to the second person. And we're thinking, what the hell went wrong with that? We were so cheery and charming. And I wonder if I gave him the wrong instructions or I was rude or the translating machine, the app had sort of somehow missed out some Polish politenesses. So I couldn't play the app back, but it did do it, recorded all the conversations as printed.
As text.
As text, exactly. So I ran it back and, oh, yes, this thing, the first bit about the lovely view and the mountains where this cheese was made. And then we came to the bit with the ladder, going up the ladder towards the gutter. And what was printed there was, you pop up that ladder ahead of me and show me your plump ass and I'll fuck it till I'm done. It's like, what the hell?
Oh my God.
And it was all printed out. And if it hadn't been printed out, I thought, that can't be. It cannot have. There was nothing that I said that could possibly, in any kind of, you know, double meaning of words, said that. So whether it was an app, it was a free app. So beware, anybody. Your free app
well,
may be tampered
you see,
with.
You get what you pay for.
Get what you bloody
pay for. Oh my God. No, I just think the word gutter, I think, oh, something's going to go wrong here.
Yes.
There's going to be some...
That could have been the key, I guess. Oh. Gutter could have tipped it off into the kind of X-rated.
So the guy thought you were asking, oh my God.
He thought I was hinting some, but obviously thought...
Perhaps... Hinting? Hinting? We left hinting way back there.
I'm amazed.
Oh my God.
I mean, not to be generalised, but Poland isn't, you know, especially now, isn't a kind of particularly... gay-friendly countries. Amazing.
Friend
to sort
of the
kill
gays.
Me then and
no.
there. But he seemed to kind of
yes,
get over
right.
that. He just
slowly... They banned them, didn't they? I mean, they said they don't exist.
Exactly. They don't
that
make
the
their
thing.
Own.
The, yeah.
There are no gays in Poland. Apparently.
Don't have... No. Oh, my God. That's absolutely hilarious. So you've... But you still have people come and help you, don't you, do things? And you had some...
Yes. I don't use an app anymore, obviously.
I love the number of scrapes you get into and the number of jobs you've had. And also, you know, when I first met you, how we first met was, I should tell everyone, was when you auditioned to be either Rosencrantz or Guildenstern. I can't remember, or maybe one of either.
Yeah, that's right.
When I was giving my Hamlet, and that we met when you came to audition for that. And that was in 1993. That's before I knew... Susie, actually.
Oh, was it?
And yeah, because I did Hamlet before I did Cabaret, and I met her when I did Cabaret. So, but you know, I was going to say, just like, when was that? At some point during the pandemic, Grant and I were watching on the Criterion Channel. We were watching all these old films, and there you were in Morris in the Merchant Ivory film. Morris, which I'd forgotten you were in.
Oh my God, that's
And so
right.
that was when you were an actor, and I'd been in those. Were you in more than one Merchant Ivory film?
Yeah, I was in three, actually. I think I was in Morris and Remains of the Day, although I was cut out of that, so I'm no longer there. And what was the third one? Howard's End.
What did you play in Howard's End?
Howard's End, I was... God, I can't even remember. Isn't that awful? I was some sort of peripheral, you know, sort of 1910 figure larking around. I can't remember what I was doing now. I seem to remember a lot of, they were very kind of authentic, the makeup person and the costume person, which actually I think has stood them in really good stead. When you watch them now, most people do seem to have the kind of look of the times. So they don't have crazy 70s do's.
No.
It's not like watching Dr. Zhivago or something, where they all have kind of bouffant 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
So we weren't allowed to wash our hair, I remember, when we arrived. We were told for sort of the month before the filming not to be able to wash our hair. And for some reason, I suppose they were autumn 1913-ish time. And I remember in Morris, mm-hmm. anyway, with my very, very kind of unwashed hair, we went for the costume fitting. There was one, again, very authentic hat that people had come out of the Boer War. And, of course, you always think of boaters and things, but this particular hat, at the time, people had also worn because it was fashionable from the Boer War. And the costume woman said, how about you, Andy? Would you like to wear this hat amongst your group of three fellow students of Clive, I think was Clive and Morris, Hugh Grant and James Wilby. So I went, okay, yeah, great. So I tried the hat on, and the hat was huge. So it was like wearing a giant halo on my head. So even though I had about five lines, every scene I'm in, you see me framed by this vast hat rim. So that was quite a good move. But when we first met, there was lots of things going on at the same time. Because I remember also there was that meeting at the audition. And then one of, again, of my kind of micro jobs was being a checker of outfits for models at the sort of final show of the London fashion thing. They used to have the London Fashion Week. They'd have a kind of the best of in the V&A, was it? I think it was the V&A.
Yeah.
Those museums.
I think it was, in a big tent.
Exactly.
Next to the V&A. John Galliano was getting a big award, wasn't it? Wasn't that the night?
I think
it was.
And
you were there.
And I was there. My job, again, I think I was staying with my friend Charlotte, who's a stylist. And she needed somebody to be kind of ticking off all the models wearing the right outfits and their pants were hanging in the right place and all that. So I said, I'll do it. So that was my job that day. I was a person kind of surrounded by naked models, passing them shirts and ticking off their names on a clipboard. And I came out to take a breather. I go, oh, my God. And there you were, you and Saffron right side. So it's you again. So we kept on meeting. We kept on
kind of being
in the same little spheres. And then there was an actress called Cameron Mannheim who did an American
movie. Yes.
And then she was a friend of a friend of mine.
She was in Romy and Michelle's high school reunion with me.
Exactly. That was it.
Yeah. And she came over to London.
She came over to London. And I knew her through a friend I was at drama school with. And I think she didn't know we were friends. That was it. We had made friends. And she said to me, I'm working with this actor called Alan Cumming. You would love him. You've got to be friends. You've got to be friends. You two. You would love each other.
How funny.
I know. And it was true.
That's so true.
She was right.
Oh, that's so funny. And I'd forgotten about that thing about the V&A, the fashion thing, because what I remember from that night was it was a special award that Galliano was getting. And Saffron, who was my girlfriend at the time, she'd worked with him a lot. And so she came down, you know, sort of wearing all his best outfits. And she had to come and she had to be ripping these pages out of a book whilst maybe it's the Bible or something, like wearing a fabulous sort of crazy outfit. And her hair was all, you know, bonkers. I remember like going home that night with her and she had all like sort of chalk and weird shit in her hair. It was really crazy living with a supermodel because they would always have weird stuff in the bed from the shoot the day before.
Well, I was a person sweeping that out of the corridors. I was a person kind of as the light of Saffron came off and sprayed all their chalk and glitter and stuff. And Andrew, can you sweep that out of the way? Out of the way. So I was a kind of a person clearing it for the next model to come and spurt.
That's so funny. I love you, Andrew. It's been so great talking to you about our
chatting.
If this acting lark doesn't pan out for me, I know I've always got a career as a lampshade shop boy.
Absolutely. Or even olive harvester.
Olive harvester. Actually, I'm more likely to go back to that. That would be right up my street
as a
sort of a farmer wannabe. Good luck with quarantine.
And you
good
too.
Luck with everything, and I'll talk to you soon, and thank you for walking down memory lane with me today on Alan Cumming Shelves.
It was absolutely lovely. Thank you. Enjoy the wander. I loved it. And I love you.
Yay. Love you.
Love you
bye.
Too. Bye bye bye.
Well, that's all the time we've got, folks. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time on Alan Cumming Shelves. Alan Cumming Shelves is hosted by me, Alan Cumming, and produced by the lovely Jack Claremont, We are part of the Acast Creator Network and the Crowd Network too. We just love networks. Another Crowd Network podcast to check out is Death of a Film Star. These are the stories of Hollywood icons like Heath Ledger, Carrie Fisher, Robin Williams, and more. They're beautifully written episodes, all around 25 minutes long, and they pay tribute to some of the greatest actors that have ever been. The episode about Chadwick Boseman is brilliant. So check it out. Just search for Death of a Film Star in your podcast app.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.